Thank you so much. I hope people got an opportunity to have a break over and catch something to eat. And then, it felt like you brought all this fantastic, in this recent debrief, you brought this energy back together into this space. And just to say that one of the most encouraging things that I found as an educator is when what I have to bring has already been named by participants in this space. And so I just want to say that I feel like where we're headed in the next, 20, 30 minutes or so is really about bringing together the wisdom that is already in the house and highlighting it and sort of framing it. So hopefully you'll find a piece of yourself in what we're talking about in this next section. So let me just jump in, as Catherine said, into that topic of community harm and healing. Isn't it interesting how the most important communities in our life, whether that's biological family or faith communities or kinship or whatever our closest community members are, they are many times the places that can bring us the most joy, but also can bring us the most sorrow. And again, this goes back to what everybody has been talking about with regards to the sort of light and shadow side, right? And it is both. And precisely because we care so much about community, and precisely because that is where we allow ourselves to become the most vulnerable, that's where we are also the most open to harm. And so it's both of those pieces. So let's have a quick look here at a little bit more on this. We covered a little bit for those of you that weren't here this morning. We talked about trauma as a whole system, having impacts on the whole system and having us ask ourselves questions about who we are and how we do life together in community. We also talked about resilience and some of the challenges of uncertainty and how when we can't just put a Band-Aid on, when we can't just have easy answers, it becomes complicated. This afternoon, or at least it's an afternoon in my time, we want to talk a little bit about how do organizations, as Catherine said, what are the typical sort of response systems? Let's now bring the outside world in to inform our conversation. Up till now, we've been talking about our own experiences and reflecting on those. But if we were to bring in a larger container of what's happening in the larger field of trauma awareness within communities, what does the how does that inform our journey? So let's start with two pieces. The one in terms of many times typical community or organizational institutional responses to trauma. And then a piece on resilience responses. And again, I feel so reinforced by the fact that so much of this has been talked about. So let's just start for a minute with the blindness and denial. I was really struck with the words of, I want to salvage my devotion. What is it about when our community members, and especially leaders, if their shadow side becomes visible, what do we do with that, right? And how a number of folks in the debrief talked about how scary that is, how unnerving that is, how unsettling that is. There's a term that I like to use, it's called trauma treason. And what that's about is that in naming our trauma, it feels like heresy. It feels like treason because we are calling out some of those shadow pieces. And that's why it's so often not allowed. That's why there's a silencing, an erasure, a disavowal of conversations around truth because they cause us to reevaluate some of those shadow pieces. And so many communities then turn a blind eye because the courage that it takes to name that feels too threatening, to the collective. And if it hazards the survival of the collective, then it becomes all the more threatening. And so we shut that down because we want to go forward. And this goes back to the comment this morning about going backwards and forwards at the same time, right? Denial is also, it was interesting that folks were also reflecting on the idea of truth, right? So I remember right before the Truth Commission in South Africa, Desmond Tutu did this incredible sort of presentation to the nation, a sort of state of the nation kind of talk. And he talked about, and it was interesting that folks were talking about a variety of types of truth. Desmond Tutu talked about four types of truth: forensic truth, which is the facts, right? And oftentimes that is perceived to be the truth, right? Oh, let's understand this happened, then this happened by this person at this time, and so on. But he said, that is just one sliver. He said, there's also personal truth, which is what is my experience of what happened? And sometimes forensic and personal truth seem disparate. They seem different one from the other. And then he talked about socio-political truth, which is the accumulation of multiple people's truths, right? And those can sometimes contradict the individual's truth, right? Depending on your community allegiance. Right? There are multiple perspectives. And then he talks about healing truth. And healing truth takes on a whole nother set of requirements. Because if you compare, for instance, forensic truth to healing truth, the action steps that need to be taken can move us in two very different directions. And how do we bring this pie together and say that we need pieces, we need strands of all of those pieces of truth? Because if we don't address those truth issues, we will remain stuck in the denial and blindness. Because talking about the loyalty narratives, talking about the truth pieces, talking about the devotion pieces, all the values that were named, it seems like these difficult conversations hazard. It makes it risky, right? Because we address the shortcomings of when we haven't lived up to all of those values in their fullness. So many times communities turn to that denial and blindness as sort of a way to shut out. And how many times have we seen this politically and historically with mass atrocities too, right? So this is not just an individual community. This is a whole trend across history, just absolute denial, right? Because it feels like it hazards too much of what we value. Another sort of response that and again, these are natural. This happens all the time when we are, you know, in situations where we feel wounded, where we feel injured. We want to shut it out, right? The numbing thing. So let's go to the physiology of numbing. Has anybody here ever had, you know, your leg go to sleep when you were like sort of, that's an American term, where you feel pins and needles in your leg or your foot because you've been laying on it, you know, strangely? What is that about physiologically? Is that the circulation, the blood flow has been severed, right? And so when your leg or your arm or your hand come back, you know, into circulation, it feels really, really strange, right? That's another thing that often happens when we are afraid of those courageous conversations, is that it feels like the easiest thing to do collectively is to say, oh, well, it was the pathology of individuals over there, right? It's we other people, right? We dissociate. That was another word that came out on the reflection, right? In the share back just now. We dissociate. And so we distance ourselves. We say, okay, we're going to stop the circulation here. And it's just a leg problem, right? And so relationships fracture and break. And so is responding to trauma in the collective, not only is it difficult because it causes us to reevaluate our values and how we aren't living into them, but it causes us to look at relationships And that's the hard part, because that's another word that came forward was the fracturing, right? We dissociate from certain people because their narrative, their story of what happened is different than ours, right? And I think, you know, when we think of psychologically, even with the childhood sexual abuse, you know, children often dissociate, and adults as well, from painful experiences. And again, these are natural responses, right? It feels overwhelming, system overwhelm. And so we shut out, right? We shut out, you know, other perspectives, we shut out other people, you know, it just seems like too much, right? But I think the issue here is if we get stuck in any one of these phases. And I think with the hypervigilance and flooding, I probably should have put them in the opposite order. This goes back to the comment this morning about intrusive thoughts and how sometimes we have an emotional wave. It's called emotional flooding, because we feel like there's a system when we realize that it's not just our leg that is, you know, sleeping on us or disconnected or whatever. When we realize that it's a whole system issue, then the emotional flooding comes and we don't know how to regulate that. And so one of the sometimes a little bit more dysfunctional ways to regulate that is to be hypervigilant. Then we start policing everybody. Like, right? Like, you come into a meeting and you know that anything that you say will be associated with your perspective on X, Y, or Z. Right? And so there's a whole sort of, because the system is under duress, because the community feels like, wow, there's too much here at stake, then we start to regulate, right? And again, this is a natural response. We can't afford to have the system shut down indefinitely. So we try to police or to regulate how much of that emotional energy comes in, right? And again, these are natural processes. But what if we get stuck there? Like, I think about whole nations that have gotten stuck in the turmoil of conflict where everything is just flooding all the time. And we haven't found functional systems to work with truth-telling processes, to work with reintegration processes, to work with, and here's, I'm going to talk about this in a minute, memorialization processes. Last thing here before we move on to resilience is, what does it mean to be trauma organized? And I just want to speak from my own life experience here. My parents were 30 years in the Middle East. And so I was in the Middle East during the Six-Day War. I was there for the 1973 Yom Kippur War. I was there during the Gulf War. And as a child, you know, I imbibed so much of you know, what is life in conflict zones. And so one of the things that still sticks with me is that when there is, you know, the sonic booms when airplanes come over really, really fast, I remember that sound from when bombs were falling. And so that immediately makes me frightened. So even in the US, for instance, during 4th of July, when the fireworks are going off, and I feel profoundly unsafe because of my associations. Again, goes back to that conversation we had this morning around intrusive thoughts, right? And emotional flooding too. So when a community becomes trauma organized, it means that it has the same responses today that reflect the initial trigger event. But sometimes that's not always an appropriate or accurate response. When there's 4th of July fireworks going off, I should be happy, right? With everybody else. But I'm bound to that original triggering event. And in collective life, what that means is that sometimes we exist in that minefield, that no man's or no-go zone, because we're still living in light of the trauma. And that goes back to that question this morning, or earlier today, around going backwards and forwards. If we only focus on the backwards, and especially for generations that haven't been engaged in creating that history, right? then we're also trapped. So the whole point here is to say these are natural responses, but when we get stuck collectively in any one of these spaces, and I can think of whole universities, I can think of whole nations, I can think of whole communities that have gotten stuck in any one of these sort of seasons of dealing with trauma collectively. Let me just say a couple of words now on resilience responses. So one of the things that struck me, I was overhearing some of the conversations earlier today, and this whole idea of curiosity and inquiry, I know Catherine has mentioned it too, but I was thinking about it with regards to an inquiry from, in terms of forensic truth, right? An inquiry is about that that naming of harms that are done, that have been done, right? But what happens when, as a group, we haven't had time to grieve or mourn the fact that it's happened here in our family, in our sacred tradition, in our backyard, in our home? What do we do with that, right? And so inquiry in that way actually means that they call it the sort of myth of exceptionalism, right? We think that, oh no, this will never happen in our group. This won't happen here. And then it does happen here. And so how can we work with processes that continue to bring transparency and accountability? And these are issues, again, this is another word that surfaced. These are issues of power. These are issues of structure, right? And it was interesting, I did some research around three different groups. It was the Hasidic Jewish communities in the early 2000s in New York, and then Amish communities in the late, it was from about 2015 and on, and then earlier than that, also working with the Jesus people in the 1970s in Chicago. And one thing I found that was in all of these communities, faith communities, had situations of sexual harm that were surfacing. And one thing that was really interesting and that was part of the light and shadow was that all of those were very insular communities. And there was something about their insularity from, in other words, they were distinct. Think about the Amish. They have a whole dress code, right? They have their very, part of what I mentioned this morning about the investment, it's strong, right? But then somehow there is sometimes a little bit less accountability to the external players that are outside of the community. And so things can happen within communities that are insular that then become all the more hidden. So again, each of these has its strength and its weakness, but fostering processes of rigorous inquiry. But it's interesting, one of the survivors that I was talking to from within this community recently talked about a gentle process of grieving. And that doesn't mean that we don't need to be rigorous with it, but at the end of the day, to actually bring the fullness of the healing truth, it also has to allow for it to emerge organically and with, and this goes into our second piece, compassion. How do we create cultures of care? So much about that is about bringing in people, their investment, their ownership into the process. From the folks that have the most structural power to everyday people. One of the organizations that I recently have been working with on these types of issues, they asked me to do a national survey to hear from folks on the ground. They were tired of hearing from all the powers that be. And so we did a national survey and we gathered that material to say, what are people saying that are you know, everyday folk living into this? And how can we do this work with integrity? Creating communities of care recalibrating our focus. How can we essentially not, and this is, you know, each one of these pieces is an opposite to the trauma responses. So instead of the emotional flooding, how can we work with focused direction and purposefulness? And here, this is something that the community itself has to decide. This cannot be imposed externally. This has to be about, for instance, I mentioned the word of memorialization processes. And I think, you know, with many harms that have been done across history and individual harms, as well as collective harms, acknowledgement is important, and a way to capture that piece of the story is critically important. And this has to do with my recent work that I mentioned earlier today with the lynching TRC, Truth and Reconciliation process in the state of Maryland, to say part of this story never got recognized. So now we're going to have community events where we name the people that were harmed. And Brian Stevenson does fantastic work on this, where he actually has these glass jars, and this is for atrocities, obviously, against African-Americans specifically and people of color, but where he has these jars of the ashes, of the remains, to say, we need to see and feel and recognize stories that have been hidden. So focusing on how, what are the ways that we can do that public acknowledgement, not just personal, right, but public and structural acknowledgement. And lastly, you know, I know that, you know, certainly the Eastern traditions of medicine know this so much better than many of the Western traditions. But how do we not get stuck in the trauma responses collectively and instead have the energy moving through? How do we keep walking the journey without getting stuck in the past or the present or the future, but keep moving through as a group and as a collective? So I think my challenge to each of us is to recognize that, A, we're not in this work alone. Certainly, there are many communities that are facing similar things, but also to say, how do we do this work well? There's a wonderful article that was put in the Harvard Business Review by a young woman by the name of Jane Dutton. And she talks about the four S's of leading in times of trauma. And she talks about, for the community, what is the speed of their response? That's the first S, the speed. What is the scope of their response? In other words, how can we offer different things maybe to different constituencies, because they may need different things? So it's the speed, the scope. What's the scale? How invested are we in rebuilding? And what is that going to mean? And I also want to name one of the things that I heard over one of the breaks was just the levels of exhaustion. Carrying this for an indefinite amount of time is fatiguing work, right? And while that's true, we also hold that, you know, the scale of our investment in this is going to have to be in the long haul, right? And then lastly, they talk about what is the specialization of it? Different persons that have been harmed in different ways will need different types of supports. And so how can we hone in, listen, those deep listening processes to hear different parts of our community system and what each one specifically needs? I ask myself, and just in closing this little piece here, just to say, I ask myself these three questions. Being honest about what have we done that we need to name? What are we doing? What do we need to be about in this season? And what can we do better? And that's takes us full circle to what we started out this morning, being a learning community and using these experiences as really launching pads and leverage points to do better.